This term, could we just jump on to the next slide? Thanks, Claire. Our teaching is coming out of a book by someone called Krishkandia. The title of the book is called Paradoxology. I highly recommend it to you. We won't have a chance to look at every chapter, and there's certainly no way we're going to look at everything in the chapters that we do look at. But if you are someone that has lots of questions, and you're trying to kind of make sense of your faith in the light of the world in which we live, you will find this book enormously helpful. And I hope actually what we talk about will also be helpful. It's called Paradoxology, and it's all about the paradoxes that challenge our faith, many of which we find in the scriptures. And the problem with them is that we, that sometimes they can kind of shipwreck our faith. Sometimes we can ignore them, because if we faced them, we wouldn't know quite what to do with our response. When actually what we need to do, I think, is learn to live in the tension that they provide. Tensions like, how can a compassionate God order his people to kill people? How can an all-powerful God allow suffering? How can a God who has all the resources of the world demand so much from his followers? How can a God be one moment close to us and the next distant? You know, just think about Jesus' words at the end of his life. One minute he promises to be with them always, and the next minute he leaves them. A God who wins by losing. And the scriptures are full of tensions, and they're full of paradoxes. And we can run from them, or we can try and kind of make sense of them and live our lives in the tension that they provide. There's a tendency at times in the church to live in unreality, and that's not helpful. I think kind of the point that Krishkandia makes is that actually Christianity was never ever meant to be simple. So we're beginning with the first of those this week, and each of them in a way picks up on a different character throughout the scriptures, so it gives us a bit of a whirlwind tour of the Bible as well. This week we're with Abraham, and the paradox is the God who needs nothing because he has everything, but asks everything of us, and how we make sense of that. So we're going to look at Abraham and the issues that his story raises for us about the nature of God, about what God is like, and also what it means for us to have faith in him. The trouble with this, I've kind of used some of my own stories and some of my own kind of illustrations in this, but sometimes you can't get away from other people's illustrations because they're just simply so good. And Krish begins with this illustration. It's a story of a young woman that I think illustrates the point. It's a young lady called Guy Song, and he heard her speak at the Lesong conference for church leaders. And she shared her testimony. She had grown up in North Korea, and her father had had influence under the previous leader. But he fell from grace, and he and his family became persecuted. In the end, they fled Korea, and they went to communist China. He said you could hear the ripple of applause when this young lady described how her family had escaped persecution in Korea, gone to communist China, and there become Christians and found faith in Christ. And that's the sort of story we like, isn't it? You know, God kind of does the amazing thing in the midst of, you know, the impossible things. But that wasn't the end of the story. Her mother, whilst pregnant, contracted leukemia and died. Her father was arrested by the Chinese and was forced to return to North Korea, and she was left on her own. So the story takes a turn for the worst. He was in prison for 3 years in North Korea before being sent back to China. And again, there's another one of those moments when there's a kind of God wins kind of moment, and everyone kind of applauds in the room. But then he feels called to go back to North Korea and to share his faith with the people he grew up with. And so he leaves behind his daughter and he returns again to North Korea. And he just disappears. She never hears from her father again. Presumably he's arrested. Presumably he's executed for his faith. And there's this kind of, and everyone applauds. And Chris says he sits there thinking, I don't know that I can applaud that. You know, how does a God ask that of that young lady that has given up so much? And at times we kind of put these things on pedestals and we make them sound so great. But actually the cost, how can God ask that of that man, knowing the impact on his daughter? And it seems to me that we live in a world that, come over the next slide, that increasingly puts God in the dock. Just some current illustrations that hit me this week. You have been aware it's a year since the atrocity in France when the staff of Charlie Hebdo, the satirical magazine, were brutally murdered. And this is their cover from this week. I'm not very good with the French bit, I can't pronounce it. But basically it says, 1 year later, the assassin is still out there. And it's a satirical magazine. They choose to cause offence, and it has caused offence. It doesn't offend me. I hope it doesn't offend you, because the picture of the assassin that's still out there is God, and they're saying God's to blame. They, you know, God is in the dock. Last Sunday evening, we didn't have a 7 o'clock service. I ended up watching some TV on a Sunday evening, and I kind of caught waiting for Match of the Day, as you do. I caught a snippet of Adrian Charles, who is kind of one of these broadcasters that annoys me more than just about any other broadcaster. So I don't know why I watched it. It just was Adrian Charles in the Mediterranean, and I like the Mediterranean, and I thought I would see some nice scenery, and so I watched it. Mistake. Because basically he was going from religious community to religious community around the Mediterranean. He'd been in Turkey the week before, and he was in Israel. And he ended up interviewing just about people of every religious persuasion you could imagine in Israel, most of which irritated me even more than Adrian Charles tends to irritate me. You had some incredibly hardline evangelical Christians who I was just embarrassed about being a Christian as I listened to what they were saying. There was a delightful Jewish family celebrating Sukkot as a family and just were so full of grace and mercy, and it was beautiful. And then in Tel Aviv, there was this gay, secular Jewish man, and he was trying to unpack faith with him, and the guy said, no, I'm a Jew, but I'm an atheist. Now, I don't quite know how that one works. And he said, how can you be a Jew? Well, it's who I am. I live in the state, but I can't believe in God. When I read the Bible, and bear in mind, you know, this is the tension we live at times, isn't it? How do you reconcile the God of the Old Testament, the God of the New Testament? And he hasn't got the New Testament. He said, when I read the Bible, I can't believe in that sort of God. He said, for me, God died in Auschwitz. No more God. So kind of people have so many questions about the nature of God. And we live in a world, persecution has always been part of the reality for Christians. How does God ask of that of them? But it's not just Christians that face persecution for their faith. In Syria, it's Kurds and Yazidis as well as Christians. Where is God in all of this? And it's that question, you know, how can a God who has everything expect so much of people that follow him to suffer in this sort of way? The Bible paints this picture of a God who is all-powerful. Cover the next slide. The theological kind of term is aseity. It means that basically God is completely self-sufficient. He doesn't need anything, you know, to give him life or to fill himself. He has everything within him that he needs. He has everything. And the words of Psalm 50 kind of sum it up. I have no need of a bull from your stall or of goats from your pens. For every animal of the forest is mine and the cattle on a thousand hills. I know every bird in the mountains and the insects in the field are mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you. For the whole world is mine and everything in it. Just to jump onto the next slide. This is Krishnamurti's comment. Here lies the heart of the paradox. An all-powerful, self-sufficient God who asks for costly worship, who asks his people to give him everything. And that paradox challenges us, not just on an intellectual level, but at an emotional one too. It strikes at the core of our faith because it's about the character of God. Is he loving, kind, compassionate, or is he cruel, insecure, and greedy? So let's have a look at that God through the eyes of Abraham and that passage that was read to us today. Abraham is one of the key figures of the Old Testament. You know, for that Jew, he would have been in the heart of the Old Testament scriptures for the Jewish people. He's the founder of the Jewish faith. He provides in the scriptures a bridge, if you like, between God's dealing with creation and ordering the world and the universe in which we live and God's dealings with people. For the first time, we see in Abraham's life, it worked out what it means for someone to have a relationship with God and to follow God and to worship God and serve God and God to be their God and to watch over them. Kind of it combines cosmology. Abraham begins by having the stars pointed out and the promise that his descendants will be more than that. It picks up where creation leaves off and it takes us to people. It has his genealogy, the story of his family. And it's a story that looks like it's going to end with Abraham because there are no children and he and his wife Sarah are getting older. And it presents us with kind of some of the causes of pain that there are in the world around us. You know, it seems to me when I talk to people, there's few greater pains than childlessness. Not Sarah's words, but his granddaughter-in-law's words, Rachel's, in her childlessness, give me children or death. That desperate need to find fulfillment in that. So it deals with some of the greatest struggles. And Abraham is a recipient of God's promise. Your offspring are going to outnumber the stars. It's where, it's where God's eternal purposes meet with his purposes for one man and one family. If this was going on with Abraham today and with Sarah today, probably we will give them a reality TV show of their own. That's the sort of story they have, you know. Kind of, it's all about the impossible. Old couple have a children. And all the adventures they have along the way, it would make for gripping television. And it makes for gripping reading. An elderly couple are plucked from obscurity. And they're told that their long forgotten dreams are going to come true. It's a bit like Gosong and kind of that early part of her story. The dreams are going to be fulfilled. And there's hope for all of us in that, isn't there? That's why we preach out of Abraham so much. Because there are so many instances in his story when we see God at work at times, often despite Abraham's kind of best intentions to get it wrong, if you like. Despite his obscurity, he lives in a tiny place in the middle of nowhere. Despite his age, despite his failings, which are so many, you know, if he's given a choice, he invariably makes the wrong one. Yet God's plan is fulfilled for his life. And that's the sort of faith that makes sense to us, I think. Trusting a God who fulfills your dreams. But that takes us to the passage that was read today. The promise has been fulfilled. He has this child. Sarah has borne a boy, Isaac, in her old age. Completely against human possibility, God has done the miraculous. But now we discover that God not only does the impossible, but he demands the impossible. It's easy to worship God when things are going well, but what do we do when they're not? Can we have the next slide? Thanks. God makes this ridiculous demand to Abraham. Take your son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah, sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on the mountain that I will show you. This doesn't just represent one death, does it? It represents Isaac's death, but it also represents the death of all of Abraham's dreams for a future. It represents Sarah's dreams of maternity being dashed, all of her maternal pride and joy. Come with the next slide. Christopher Hitchens, the atheist, says all three monotheisms, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, praise Abraham for being willing to hear voices and then take his son Isaac for a long and gloomy walk, and then the caprice by which his murderous hand is finally stayed is written down as divine mercy. It comes from Hitchens' book, God is Not Great. And you can kind of see that that sums up kind of what Christopher Hitchens thinks about God and the sort of God that would ask that of Abraham. What sort of God does this? Does the God who forbids murder tell Abraham to kill his son? It raises questions about the nature of God. And it also raises questions about what it means to have faith in that God. What it means to believe in him. Can we have the next slide? The New Testament describes Abraham as the father of all those that believe, the father of faith. He isn't just the father of the Jewish nation. Kind of our roots as Christians kind of go right back to him. He's the model of what it means to trust in God. And so much of that comes out of this particular incident in his life. Trusting God that God could even raise Isaac from the dead. Paul writes, Abraham believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness. The story doesn't tell us anything about Abraham's inner turmoil. We can only imagine that. And we're left to ask our own questions about what's going on there. Is this kind of some step of blind faith, kind of stepping into the abyss with his child, willing to end his own child's life and end all of his hopes? Is that what faith looks like? A step into nothing? Is that faith? Am I the only one that's had people say to me, I really admire your faith? People say that to you? Yeah, people say that to you? Yeah? You know, and kind of on one level, you're kind of thinking, I think you do. But on another level, you may be thinking, what you're really saying is, but I'm not that gullible. Or am I just cynical? I don't know. Richard Dawkins, another atheist, describes faith as the process of non-thinking. Is faith a step in the dark? Is it blind faith? Is it a process of non-thinking? Is that what Abraham does here? Or is there more to it than that? Well, I don't think that's the picture that the Bible paints of faith. First of all, faith isn't a leap in the dark. The Bible provides reasons for faith. Jesus describes his words as evidence for belief. John, when kind of explaining why he wrote his gospel, says these things have been written so that you might believe. Luke, when he writes his gospel and kind of addresses it to this man, Philophilus, kind of talks about gathering evidence. So faith in the scriptures isn't unreasoned, it's based on evidence. And Abraham isn't taking a step of blind faith. He has his eyes open. And he may not have heard about Jesus or read about Jesus or seen the New Testament, but his actions are based on what he's already seen of God's activity in his own life. He already knew God's provision. He'd already seen God's miraculous action in his own life. He'd already seen that God could bring life to what was dead. He'd experienced it in his own and in Sarah's bodies, just in having that child. So faith isn't just a blind leap in the dark. It's based on reason. And faith flows out of relationship. Abraham had heard God speak to him many times. He had developed a relationship that was based on trust. As I kind of said before when I was introducing Abraham, if you look at the story of Abraham, time and time again, it's almost like Abraham has kind of demonstrated the opposite of faith. He's not trusted God. He's done almost the opposite of what God would ask. And yet, even though he's never kind of got it right, God has still never let him down. And so his faith is based out of his experience, out of the relationship that he has with God. God may seem to be acting out of character in asking for this, but he knows how God has acted in the past. Think of the mother, and this is a bit of a sore point in our family, who takes their child for an injection. Now, Carol makes me take them, but never mind. That's mainly because Daniel has this habit of passing out when he's injected. But never mind. He'll probably be listening to it later on the tape, don't worry. But when you take a child and they're young, that child knows that their mother loves them. They go to the doctor and the doctor shoves a needle in them. How do they make sense of that? They don't understand that the needle's doing them good. The person that's demonstrated love to them has hurt them. But in the end, they trust the character of the person that they love and they thankfully forget about the pain quite quickly. They might remind you about it from time to time and try and extract sweets or what other kind of menaces that kind of can be kind of done. It's based on relationship and the knowledge that the mother loves the child. And faith and reason actually aren't opposed. When it talks about Abraham's faith in the New Testament, it says that he uses reason. Abraham reasoned that God could raise the dead. He looked at what had happened in his experience and he thought it out. And in his mind, he believed that God could go beyond what he could see. It was based on the evidence of God's character and the evidence of his experience of him. So faith isn't an unreasoned step in the dark. It's not a process of non-thinking. Reason and faith go together. With the next slide, thank you. But it still asks the question, why? Why does God ask this of Abraham? He climbs the mountain and he builds an altar. He lays Isaac on it and he raises the knife. And then God intervenes and tells him to stop. Did we have to go there in the first place? What's the point? Why put Abraham through all of that emotional ordeal? And I think it's about revealing what is most important. C.S. Lewis comments that he believes that we desire great things. It's kind of built into humanity to have hope for our lives, to expect great things and to desire great things. But there's also something within the human frame that we settle for mediocrity rather than chasing after that greatness. Our desires should lead us to God and to the relationship with Him that has the potential to fulfill everything in our lives. But frequently, we base our happiness on what He gives us, on food, on drink, on material things, even on relationships. It's God that should satisfy our greatest inbuilt needs, not what He gives us. Lent's approaching. What Lewis is talking about is part of that whole principle of fasting and self-denial. We let go of the material so that we are confronted with what is eternal and what has lasting value. And this is kind of like the hyperbole picture of letting go of the most valuable thing someone could have. What more valuable thing? In trust that God is going to work good out of it and there is something better. And can you see something of that principle at work in this passage? Many of us know from experience that we're drawn closer to God through pain and difficulty and in times of suffering. And now we need, in my notes, there's a bracket here, don't miss this bit. We need to be really careful not to say that God causes those things, but God can work through them and can use them. And I think we need to be clear that in this account we have here, in God's dealings with Abraham, we have an exception, not a rule. The biblical principle for us discipleship isn't go off and sacrifice your children. It's a confrontation that has, and a challenge that has meaning, not just for Abraham, but for others. The situation is an exception, not a rule. Those of us that are parents often feel keenly the need to provide for our children. We want to provide for their physical needs. You know, we want to make sure they have everything they could want. Actually, perhaps not everything they want. That might not be good for them, actually, but everything they might need. But actually, I don't know whether you've thought about it. Surely the most important thing we can give them is not a new Wii, or even the food that's on their table, or clothes, or a roof over their head. The most important thing that we can give them is ourselves. Our love, our acceptance, our constancy, our presence in their lives is more valuable than anything else we give to them. It's out of that that their security and their ability to flourish grows. That's the foundation of life. And when it comes to God, that's how it works. The greatest gift is God Himself. And yet it's so easy for us to get caught up on the things that He gives. And God is stripping it away for Abraham and asking, do you trust me? And this is all about trusting in the goodness of God. You know, knives can be used in all sorts of ways, not just to eat our Sunday lunches. A thug can use a knife to maim. And we live in a society where there's far too much knife crime. But a surgeon can use one to heal. And Abraham acts out of the security of knowing that God works in his life for good. That God works in his life to heal. That God works for his good and for Isaac. And that comes out of his knowledge of God's character. And there's also something about this that anticipates a greater provision. Instead of his son Isaac, God provides a ram for the sacrifice. God fulfills Abraham's own words to Isaac. The Lord will provide. On that day, it was a ram stuck in a thicket on a mountainside. But that mountain that God has directed Abraham to is Mount Moriah. Eventually, it will not just become the site of Jerusalem, but also of the temple, the places in the Old Testament where the sacrifices will be offered that will kind of, that will regularize this relationship between God and his people and will point to a greater sacrifice, just as this story does. Eventually, that place where Abraham and Isaac travel and where God provides becomes the place where Jesus' crucifixion takes place. God provides. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not have perish, but have eternal life. Jesus isn't a child dragged to Moriah like Isaac might have been. He goes there willingly, choosing our life over his own. None of these things give us neat questions. You can still feel the pain and the tension that runs through this story. But there's still a sense of mystery about it. And when we face loss or difficult choices, there are equally not easy answers. And at times it can be hard to see where God is in those situations. Or why God is asking it of us, it seems. And expecting us to go through it. There might not be easy answers, but we can approach it with the knowledge that God can be trusted. He isn't the thug, he's the surgeon. And that he's chosen to provide. No one coerced Jesus to the cross. He goes willingly in our place so we can have life and so our relationship with his Father can be restored. Let's pray. Lord, just sometimes dealing with the questions is painful. And making sense of suffering, either in our own lives or in the enormity of what we see in the lives of others, every time we turn on our television sets, is hard. Making sense of how we're to live and where you are in it, it would be easy to adopt that headline and picture from Charlie Hebdo. Lord, thank you that you don't run away, but you walk onto the hillside. And you show us your love. Amen.